You are listening to a sermon by Carl Friesen, recorded on Sunday, March 24, 2013, at the Point Grey Interminonite Fellowship in Vancouver, British Columbia. The opinions expressed by the speaker are not necessarily those of the church. This recording is licensed for personal use by individuals only, and may not be copied, broadcast, or redistributed without the prior permission of the church board. For more information, please visit our website at www.pgimf.org.
I grew up in a world of ritual. Although it may not always have been seen as ritual to my parents or to the church that I grew up in, my world was a ritualized and intensely structured world. Every day of the week had a rhythm or a kind of a cadence to it, and I could have predicted what every day would look like. So we would get out of bed before dawn. We'd go to the barn and milk the cows, we'd clean the alleys, we'd lay down bedding, feed the cats, clean up after the milking process. Then we'd go inside, take a shower, eat breakfast, have family devotions, and then go to school. After school, we came home, had something to eat, went back to the barn to do chores again, and after we were done in the barn, we came inside, washed up, had supper, and then we had about 2 hours to get our homework done and hopefully have a little bit of free time before night snack and going to bed. And this is how every day was structured. And this was the ritual of our everyday lives, and it was never disturbed unless there was some dire circumstance that really needed our attention. But ritual also went way beyond our daily schedule. For example, we absolutely never, and I mean never, skipped anything at church. Our church service had the exact same structure every single week. Every holiday throughout the year had its own set of rituals that we would do every single year, and on and on. These were the kinds of rituals that shaped us and made us understand who we were. So these were kind of weekly or annual rituals that formed us into certain kinds of people, whether we realized it or not. And there were many rules and rituals, whether spoken or unspoken, that helped us to know who we were and what we stood for. But there was also other rituals that formed and shaped us that had a very negative aspect to them. So, for example, the church that we participated in refused to participate in any community events with other churches or social groups. We were not allowed to go to town to participate in youth events outside of our own church, or go to hockey games, or go to the theater, and so on and so forth. We had to dress a specific way, and on and on. And we habitually feared those that looked or acted differently than we did, simply presuming that we were on, or that they were on, a sure path to hell, while our own convoluted traditions and rituals were exactly what Jesus had envisioned as he walked the earth. Now, I'm being a little bit facetious here, to be sure, but this is not to take away from the point, which is that we lived in an explicitly ritualized world, and we told ourselves certain stories about who we were, and it helped us to know who we were, and maybe even more so, who we were not. We are not those people, we are these people. And so this kind of ritual-driven world that I lived in was perhaps even more intensified for a first century Jew. In many ways, the lives of a devoted Jew would seem to be driven even more by rituals, practices, symbols, and habits than most of ours are. Although perhaps we have just as many rituals, they were just more aware and intentional about what theirs were. But in this season, as we wrestle with the true strangeness of the Easter story and the Holy Week events, let's ponder the events leading up to Good Friday and Easter, and let's try to do so from the world of a first century Jew and kind of this framework that they were working within. A person, what would the average Jew, completely steeped in the Jewish traditions and narrative, think was taking place? So let's try to imagine what Jesus' death and resurrection meant in light of the events that were leading up to his death and resurrection. So specifically, I want to focus on the passage in Luke chapter 19 that was read already. So in our passage today, in Luke 19, we follow Luke's version of the story that begins what is known as Holy Week, generally, in the church. So from the beginning of his narrative, all the way from the beginning of the Gospel of Luke, Luke has been subtly building up to the center of his story about Jesus. And the center of his story is Jerusalem. So all the way from chapter 9, if you go through the book of Luke, all the way from chapter 9, he has been consistently reminding his readers that Jesus is on the way to Jerusalem. I believe it's in 9 verse 51, he first mentions that Jesus starts this journey toward Jerusalem. So in a sense, he's telling his whole entire story as though from chapter 9 verse 51 till where we are today, when he actually reaches Jerusalem, is all one long journey toward Jerusalem. And throughout, he reminds you that you were on the way to Jerusalem. Now notice here in chapter 19, he also uses the phrase, as they drew near, several times, as a kind of a rhetorical device to remind us that the story is coming to a head, the climax is drawing near. And this is the climax that his whole story, his gospel, his good news story has been pointing towards. And finally, in a sense, he's saying, finally we will get to see who Jesus really is. And then we join the story in verse 28, which is where our passage started today. And we are on the path with Jesus and his disciples through the deserts of Jericho to the city of Jerusalem. And the religious fervor is in the air. You can literally feel it. It is Passover time, and there are hundreds of pilgrims making their way to Jerusalem on foot from all over Palestine to participate in the Passover celebration. And this is a special occasion and celebration as the devoted make their way to the holy city for the ritual of all rituals in the Jewish world. This Passover celebration is not just some kind of a commemoration for them, like a memorial service or something like that. It's, in essence, it's a retelling of the climax of Israel's story, which is Yahweh's deliverance of his people from Egypt, out of slavery. So Jesus and his followers are also making their way to Jerusalem for the festivities. They're walking together. People are singing and chanting Passover hymns together as they walk for days on end in anticipation. Jesus is gathering some attention, though, as a small band of people cluster around him to listen to him tell stories and to see him do wonderful deeds of healing and deliverance as they pass through town after town on their way to Jerusalem. Remember, the way Luke tells it, all the parables and miraculous signs or wondrous deeds or whatever you want to call them between chapter 9 and 19 are all considered part of this journey toward the Passover. So as people become increasingly intrigued by this strange Jewish man and what he is doing, one can imagine that a small crowd is beginning to form and to walk together to the holy city. But the crowd does not just see Jesus as simply some kind of a wonder worker, as though he's some amazing magician that they want to watch. No, the wondrous deeds he is acting out are signs of the coming age. That's what makes them so excited. These are signs that perhaps Yahweh is indeed here. That's part of the growing excitement. So people begin to whisper to each other, who is this man? Can he truly be sent by Yahweh? Dare we hope that he is truly Yahweh's sent one? And people are wide-eyed and taken in by Jesus as he tells story after story and heals person after person like they have never seen or heard before. And then, right after telling the story of a king that goes to a foreign land to be crowned king, which is the beginning of chapter 19, right after telling that story, Jesus tells two of his 12 disciples to go and fetch a colt and to bring it to him. And again, this is not arbitrary. Jesus is not just tired and in need of a rest. He has walked all over Palestine for his entire life. No, Jesus is coming to Jerusalem with the intention to claim his royal status as king, but of course he's doing it in a very scandalous way. So in a sense, he is acting out the story that he has just told, that he's just been telling. And the crowds, swept up in this kind of euphoric moment of awe and hopefulness, begin to chant what was for them a very familiar Jewish Passover chant, which is from Psalm 118. Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. Note, however, that in Luke's story, they also add the title of king to their song of adulation. That is not in Psalm 118. So they say, blessed is the king who comes in the name of the Lord. And this is quite the political and religious act as they chant and sing on the way down the Mount of Olives and into the bustling and religiously charged city of Jerusalem, which would be just swelling with pilgrims from all over Palestine. Now imagine the scandal and the irony at the same time here. Here's a peasant riding a little donkey into Jerusalem for the Passover feast with people chanting a traditional Passover hymn to him, to this Jewish guy on a donkey, and saying that he is king, or treating him as though he is a king. So here's a Jewish carpenter riding into this crowded, bustling city where there's this religious fervor going on, and religious excitement even. And the people are treating him as though he is actually something special. And he is doing so on a donkey, which of course is kind of strange. And as all this is taking place, there is no doubt that any Jew that was very well versed in the scriptures would be thinking of Zechariah chapter 9, verse 9, where it states that the king of Israel, Yahweh's chosen one, would ride into Jerusalem on a donkey. So these kinds of things are very much in the very committed Jew's mind as they see this unfolding. They couldn't help but notice those things. And certainly Luke is alluding to Zechariah chapter 9. But of course we know this story doesn't end there. And this is not a story of a hero coming home to the adulation of his people. There's a dark cloud hanging over Luke's story. Upon entering Jerusalem, Jesus goes into the temple, the center of all that is Jewish, and pronounces judgment on the temple by driving out the people selling animals for sacrifice. This takes place right after him riding into Jerusalem. He goes to the temple and does his act of judgment there. And then he stays in the temple and teaches all those who are gathered to hear him. So by pronouncing judgment on the temple and then by occupying it himself, Jesus is essentially claiming the authority over the temple, over Jerusalem, and indeed over all of Israel. That is the significance of what he is doing. In some sense, it's no wonder that people are no longer quite as welcoming as they were just a few days before when they were singing of Jesus, "Blessed is the King who comes in the name of the Lord. Peace in heaven and glory in the highest heaven." Now, anyone familiar with the Christmas carols picks up on this later phrase as well. Peace in heaven and glory in the highest heaven. This is an echo of an earlier section of Luke as the story of Jesus' birth is told. The angelic host sings in the heavens above as Jesus is born. Now the disciples sing as Jesus enters into his last week of life. So for Luke's gospel, the glory of God and the peace of heaven and earth resound at both ends of the story of Jesus' life. Nonetheless, this story will not stay in the heights of praise. In a few short days, this story will come crashing down. These scenes of triumphal entry, judgment on the temple, and temple teachings fade quickly as Luke furthers the story. The religious rulers are furious and conspire to deal away with Jesus. One of the inner circle disciples decides to conspire with the powers that be. So the week that began with such high praise and anticipation for the coming of Yahweh shall end with the drama of a betrayal, a show trial, and then a summary execution. The disciples will lose their euphoria and disappear into the night, frightened for their very lives. And Jesus will be written off as yet another zealous messianic type, consigned to death by Pilate, a Roman official who just waves the entire matter away and literally washes his hands of the matter. Soon, Jesus will be put to death, abandoned by even his closest of disciples, and his corpse is left hastily in a selected tomb. This story, filled with its drama and tragedy, reminds us that the world has yet to allow the peace and hope of Jesus Christ to take abiding root. Jesus heals the marginalized and excluded and proclaims the reign of Yahweh, and yet he is rewarded with a humiliating death. So we see in Pilate and the temple priests the brutal consequences of humans exercising power and authority with little sense of restraint. We move along the narrative arc of Jesus' life and death, facing that dreadful pause of Good Friday's aftermath and the reality that we do not skip over death when telling the gospel story of Jesus. Along the way, if we learn how to tell the gospel story rightly, we sort out the curious final word of Jesus as he rides down from the Mount of Olives into the city of Jerusalem. As this kind of parade is going by, the Pharisees, who are longtime critics of Jesus, step forward and criticize the raucous singing of the disciples. And Jesus will have none of this. He says, "Even if my disciples were to be silent, these stones would shout." Now, where do Jesus' words about the stones shouting fit in with the rest of the week ahead of him? If you find this language puzzling, you need to read the Gospel of Luke again. In Luke's Gospel, people cannot help but burst into song. For example, the Nativity, as told by Luke, is a veritable musical. People are bursting into song all the time. The parables of Jesus that Luke alone records, for example, the prodigal son being the most famous one, cannot help but speak of the kingdom of God being like the party that the father gives when the rebellious son slinks back home after blowing his inheritance. For Luke, heaven and earth shimmer with stories of God's abundant love, and Jesus eats heartily alongside the people that the religion and politics of the day had written off as expendable or completely without redemption. Nothing will stop the praise of God and the kingdom that Jesus sees well on its way. Even the inanimate stones will join in God's praise if we would somehow fall silent or forget. There is surely a cross looming large as the gospel draws to a close. There will be great loss ahead, for this story is part of the world story where brokenness and tragedy are to be found. Yet in this story, cross-shaped as it is, we find a joy that breaks forth, beckoning all to join and to sing of the King who comes in all humility with all justice and peace for which this world has been yearning. So the question is, what would a first century Jew, steeped in the rituals and traditions of Judaism, see in the story of Jesus riding into Jerusalem, weeping over the city, proclaiming judgment on the temple, and then celebrating the Passover meal? So what would a first century Jew that is steeped in this world of ritual and telling of stories in order to shape their identity, what would they see with these kinds of things taking place during Holy Week? Again, Jesus riding into Jerusalem on a donkey with a crowd surrounding him, chanting a Passover hymn that he is king. And then Jesus weeps over the city, goes to the temple, proclaims judgment on the temple, and then celebrates the Passover meal with his disciples. And kind of redefines the Passover meal with his disciples. In the words of N.T. Wright, the typical Jew would see a young Jewish prophet telling a story about Yahweh returning to Zion as judge and redeemer, and then embodying it by riding into the city in tears, symbolizing the temple's destruction, and then celebrating the final exodus, the Passover meal. So Jesus' actions and words are nothing short of a retelling and a reenactment of Israel's story in such a way that Jesus has made himself the center of the story and indeed the climax of the entire story. That's what Jesus is doing here. He is proclaiming that Yahweh has come, that he will be crowned as king, and he will do so in a completely absurd way from their perspective. He will do so by washing his disciples' feet, by sharing the Passover meal with them, and then by going to be executed by the powers that be. This certainly is not the kind of king that they were expecting. The stories and rituals they had immersed themselves in did not point to this kind of kingdom. This just simply did not make sense. This is a king that rides a donkey, washes feet, and then gets executed as a criminal. It's no wonder everyone fled, as this intriguing story suddenly took a very ugly turn. Maybe he is just another failed Messiah. And at the end of the day, we all have to admit that, as the Apostle Paul reminds us, all of Jesus' actions and proclamations are ultimately pointless and even kind of insane if we do not, in fact, have Easter morning.